And just as a very short review and to work us into this section, some of the things that, or what we talked about yesterday, and again, we didn't even get through all of that, but one of the key things here that we saw as Paul talks about, nothing can separate us from the love of God in Christ Jesus. Part of what we were talking about, and this is the issue of shame, is that Christ's shameful death in behalf of the shamed bestows God's favor on those of us who deserve nothing. And so, therefore, again, because we have been given God's favor, we cannot be separated. And then, what Paul goes on to tell us in that section, where we always responded, no way, is that sufferings are not the cause for despair, but evidence for hope. Sufferings are the ways the Spirit is conforming us to Christ. Remember, we talked about in Christ, in the Spirit. Christ dwells in us. The Spirit dwells in us. It's so much so that, as Paul would have said in Galatians, it's no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And so, how does Christ dwell? How does Christ make that dwelling? How are we conformed? Paul's answer to that is it is suffering that is conforming us to Christ. We can talk about our cruciformity. And so that's why. And so our cruciformity is evidence for hope, not shame. And so today I want to go back to verses 18 to 30 because one of the key themes there is hope. And that sense of hope is for all of creation. Not just human beings, but all of creation works its way into that. And so what I have here is just breaking down those verses into at least the various themes that I see Paul wanting to address. Verse 18, he gives us the thesis statement. 19 to 21, the yearning of creation for redemption. Then 22 and 23, how human suffering is a part of creation's yearning. Then we get some specific passages in verses 24 and 25 on the clarification of hoping in a not yet redeemed world. And I definitely want to spend some time on that. Verses 26, 27 is the role of the Spirit in groaning creatures. And then, as any good musician, we got to come to a coda here. And so we have the climactic celebration of the glory to be manifested. And then part of that was also what verses 31 through 39 were about. So my guess is we probably won't say anything about it. Just because of time. Again, that sense about why we are talking about not simply human beings, but all of creation, is what this little diagram is about, is to note the creation-human parallels that Paul is making in these verses. And this is just simply to show you that what Paul talks about for creation, he talks about for humans, and vice versa, what he's talking about for humans, creation. So we've got waits for, right? Creations and humans are waiting for. He talks about creation, or again, humans as creation creatures. He uses the term bodies. Hope is there both for creation and for humans. Will be set free. Redemption. Earlier, verse 2 of Romans 8, he talked about how humans will be set free. And now he uses that exact same word for all of creation. That being set free, which is a synonym for his sense of redemption in this. Talks about creation, creatures as children of God. And he talks here again about how we as humans have been adopted as God's sons and daughters, Christ's brothers and sisters. And then there is the groaning of creation and that we ourselves also groan. So this is just simply trying to illustrate in a kind of chart way that I'm not totally wacky to think that creation, all of creation, has something to do with redemption and that Paul is very serious about that. And so, to begin. Vatican II's Pastoral Constitution, Gaudium et Spes, joy and hope. And again, all formal Vatican documents are always entitled, at least in the Latin, by the first three words in the first sentence. So that first sentence there is called joy and hope. When they want to give this document a title in English, they become exceedingly boring. We started with joy and hope, but in English this document is known as the Church in the Modern World. Whoopee. But that document, right, joy and hope, discusses human activity during the earthly life and highlights its lasting character. At the end of time, at the resurrection of the dead, this document comments, while charity and its fruits endure, all that creation which God made on humanity's account will be unchained from the bondage of vanity. Unquote. So again, therefore, right? All creation will be unchained from the bondage of humanity. And then it references 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 8 and 13, the phrase, love never ends, and also our text, Romans chapter 8, verse 21, creation itself will be set free from its bondage to death. So, given that, kind of three questions to begin to frame our study and our discussion. The first question is, to what fate is creation destined? To what fate is creation destined? Second, what is the future of the whole creation, which is currently groaning and in labor pains? What is the future of the whole creation, which is currently groaning and in labor pains? And three, what is the Christian hope for creation? What is the Christian hope for creation? That's what we want to look at. So, starting at verse 18, the thesis statement. And Paul starts out there in that thesis statement, NRSV, the first words there is, I consider. And again, that's a fine way of translating the term there. But another way that it has often been translated is I reckon. And certainly if you have the John Wayne translation, I reckon. And that's actually a good trans because the word logizomai is a mathematical or logical term. Another way of translating this is that if you have the certified public accountant's version of the Bible, it would be, I calculate. Right. I consider, I reckon, I calculate. In other words, right, what this is you are doing that kind of analysis on both sides. Remember beforehand, we had in the previous section, verse 17, we ended with sufferings and glory. So now what Paul, the accountant, the logician, the mathematician, the economist is doing is looking that he says, all right, we've got sufferings, we've got glory here. And he's saying then, all right, according to my cost-benefit analysis, right, that's what he's saying, according to my cost-benefit analysis, I've come to the conclusion, right, my statement is balancing that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that's to come. That comes from our accountant, our logician, our mathematician, Paul. When I add it up, suffering does not compare to glory. And again, that the phrase there, the sufferings of this present time, the phrase there literally again is the sufferings for this moment now. Right. What's going on right now in the sufferings? And right, we from yesterday again, we know Paul's got sufferings. He's got affliction and hunger and nakedness and all sorts of stuff. That's the now. I'm calculating that, and doesn't compare at all to the coming glory. And of course, what is the coming glory? As we read through this section, the coming glory will be the redemption of the whole of God's creation. The other thing, in terms of this moment of now, and as we're talking about this moment of now, I'll leave this up here for a second. Particularly for people in Rome to whom this letter is addressed, this moment of now, at least by the Romans, has been called the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. This is the golden age. This is the glorious age. It doesn't get any better than this. Paul goes, oh, gee, you guys don't know how to add things up. I'm sorry, Roman Emperor and Senate. I will not be hiring you as my accountant. Because you cannot calculate what's really going on. Because you see, Pax Romana, which quite frankly is suffering rather than glory, doesn't compare to what I'm talking about. The redemption of the whole creation. Let's do a cost-benefit analysis. Let's do a risk assessment on that, shall we? That's what Paul is doing here. Right? And so that's where Paul is taking us. That's where Paul wants us to go. So we will go with him. And, verse 19, the creation waits with eager longing. And again, great word for that, literally, this awaiting with eager longing means await with outstretched head, right? You know, you're a rubbernecker. That's what creation is doing. It's like all of you in the line for holding ice cream. That's what's going on, right? Creation is waiting for its double scoop. That's what's happening there. And again, this is a very positive sense of waiting. There's two ways we wait. There's confident waiting, or if you will, we'll see here, hopeful waiting. That's the kind of waiting when you are in line for your two golden scoops, right? You're confident. And then there's the anxious waiting, right? That's when you're waiting to find out whether or not you passed your test. And you're pacing back and forth, and you're anxious, and you're waiting for those kinds of things, right? Paul here is saying this is the positive, confident, hopeful faith waiting. That's what creation is doing. That's what's there. We're looking for that, right? And it's looking for what? The revealing of the children of God. Right? What is opposed to that? Verse 20, for the creation was subjected to futility. Mataoiotes. And that term is used in Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 2. Mataoiotes, matateotetaton, which we would all know as vanity of vanity. So that subjecting to futility is being subjected to vanity, to fruitlessness, to emptiness. The sense here of vanity or futility is that things are without results. They are ineffective. You never reach your telos. Greek word telos. It's at the completion. Your telos can be your end, your purpose, your goal, your aim. And if you never get there, that's futility. That's empty. I mean, the harder I work, the behinder I get. I think that's Minnesotan, isn't it? that's futility. The other great example, again, from philosophy and the illustration of futility comes from a Greek philosopher, Zeno. And Zeno liked to give his students paradoxes. And one of the great paradoxes is his story of Achilles and the tortoise. And what he says is, okay, right, Achilles again is the great Greek warrior played by Brad Pitt. Boy. Well, he was, right? And of course, Achilles was fast, right? Fastest person around. So Zeno says, all right, Achilles and a tortoise are in a race. So here's our race. And again, we know Achilles is really fast and the tortoise is kind of slow. So just to be fair, we got to handicap the tortoise a little bit. So we'll have Achilles starting here. The tortoise, let's say, starts here. But Achilles will never win the race. Why? Well, because, you go for a while. Let's say Achilles is going, and he's faster than the tortoise. So at the next time, it'll be Achilles here, the tortoise here. And then the next time it'll be Achilles here and the tortoise here. And we keep going, but you see, Zeno's notion is Achilles will always catch up to the tortoise, and we can always divide this distance. We can always have it, but as we keep cutting it in half, 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 you know, Achilles is always going to be behind the tortoise. He'll never catch up. He'll never win. Therefore, students, life is futile. Right? That's futility. You can never reach your telos, your end, aim, goal, purpose. It's not going to make it. It's futile. Or again, if we would want to look at this in further depth, if you look at Ecclesiastes chapter 2, where again the author there is going to expand on this whole vanity of vanities, right, or futility of futility. Right? He tells, you know, it's terrible. You know, it, in our drive for fame, for prestige, for achievement, it evacuates creation and it just piles up endless frustration. So that you see, no matter what you do in life, no matter how much you think you might achieve, it's just all going to be frustration. Nowhere. Futile. Empty. Fruitless. Existence is only disappointing and hopeless. That's the one sense of futility. The second sense of futility in there, in terms of its emptiness, goes back to another notion for the Greeks and others in terms of the hierarchy of being. Again, a basic way that folks were working. And the understanding of the hierarchy is that, of course, God is on the top. There are spiritual beings. Then there are human beings. Then there are animals. Then there are plants. Then there is matter. And then there are those who teach Bible study. So you've got this hierarchy, and of course on this hierarchy go with it the values. Right? So that, you know, the most worthy, the most wise, the most true, right? God, the highest good, and so on and so forth. All of that happens. But the sense of futility that comes in, and this is how sin works, is that what human beings in sin do is they reconstruct this hierarchy of being. And in reconstructing this hierarchy of being, guess who's on top? Me! Me! And then, well, if you want humans, you can, but you don't necessarily need, I mean, you know, the rest of you could all be kind of worthless. I might want to put, money up there. Power, prestige, we all, and in that sense, think about your own lives experientially, we all construct our own hierarchy. The only thing we will all have in common as sinful human beings is who's on top. Me. And there goes the hierarchy. But of course, constructing this hierarchy in this way will again be fruitless. Because you see, no matter how you construct it and all of that, you finally won't end up on top because, like it or not, you're going to die. And if you die, that's kind of proof positive you can't be on the top of the hierarchy. Because in that sense, there is one power that is more powerful than you. And that's the power of death. And living with that sense of that power of death that is even over you, everything else becomes fruitless and empty. The futility of life. And so there again, right? Verse 20 there, the creation was subjected to futility, not of its own will. It's not that creation said, hey, let's be empty and ineffective and useless. No. Right? It was subjected. And the sense here, in even though the subject of that verb is not given, it was subjected to futility by God. We might think it's subjected to futility by sinful human beings, but that's not the case. It is the passive here indicates this was subjected to futility by God. But there is that then at the very end of that verse, that little phrase in there, in hope. Well, that's a real conundrum, isn't it? Creation subjected to futility by God in hope. That, and we'll finish the rest of that clause there in a moment. But note, and again, say, okay, now try and get your head around that one, huh? Why is God subjecting it to futility, and how can a sense of futility be hopeful? Right? I mean, remember what we said about, you know, futility, vanity of vanities. You're never going to win the race. Death is always going to have the last word. And given that, it's in hope. God's doing something here, and I'm not sure what God is doing, but I am certain at this point I don't like it. Right? I don't like the sense creation subjected to futility, even if it is in hope. The other thing, the ironic, or perhaps the tragic thing about this, is that now if creation is subjected to futility, it means that the natural finds itself in an unnatural condition. Because subjected to futility is not natural. Natural was Genesis 1. Right? God creates and then looks at what God does and says, good. And on day 6, when God looked at everything, he said, Mazel Tov! Very good! Wow. Subjective. Yeah. I don't think you can say Mazel Tov to futility. That's an unnatural situation. So, you know, BC has as one of its little slogans to encourage all of you folks to come to British Columbia, right? Supernatural British Columbia. And if they'd be following Paul, they'd have to go unnatural British Columbia. How many tourists would that bring? Right? That's kind of futile to try to sell yourself as, hey, come on and be unnatural. So what is happening there, right? It is still subjected in hope. And that hope, as we will see, and so I'm going to kind of give the punchline away here a little bit, is that humans would be redeemed and participate in restoring creation. That was, if you will, Paul saying, this is why God is subjecting it to futility, in the hope that redeemed humanity will participate in the restoration of creation. That's where we're going. And so therefore, we get the good word, the redemptive word there in verse 21, right? In the hope what? That the creation itself will be set free. There's our redeeming word. Just like in verse 2, Paul had declared how we in Christ were set free. Now, again, this creation in its slavery, in its bondage to destruction, to dissolution. I mean, he kind of ups the ante here, right? The bondage to decay, that's even worse than futility, right? Because that's destruction and death. In that bondage to destruction and death, we will be, creation will be set free. Again, for Paul, it is inconceivable that humans could exercise any form of set free. Liberation, deliverance, salvation, however you want to fill in that sense of setting free, and related only to themselves. Right? Because as we talked about, if you were here in verse 2, when we are set free, that notion of being set free is we are free from sin, death, devil, law, all that would enslave and captivate us. But we are also free for. And that was the really good news. Remember to say, well, you mean I'm set free and I can do anything I want to do? Yes! You're free for that. And of course, that means you're free for working out there in creation. And so when you are set free for, that's how God is empowering us to participate in the setting free of creation. And if we don't carry through with that free for thing, if you will, we're only half saved. Because being set free from is not the full deal. It's only half saved, and of course, God doesn't do anything halfway. It's the free for there. Again, another illustration of why you got to be free from and free for. This is the end of Paul's letter to the Philippians, and he talks to us about how to get dressed, right? What the fashionable Christian is wearing, right? And that's the breastplate of salvation and all that paraphernalia. And of course, we are wearing the helmet of salvation or more particularly, justification. The free for our hat, our fedora, is the free from fedora. But think about that again in terms of how many of you walk around wearing only a hat? That's not even half dressed, is it? Unless you wear your hat down there. Right? But that's it, right? Here again, the whole sense that we are free for is kind of saying, folks, you got to wear more than your hat. And being fully clothed means that we are dressed, we are wearing the right clothes, we've got the uniform on for our work of setting creation free. That's what we're doing, right? That's what God in Christ was all about, setting us free from and free for, so that we are dressed, we are clothed for precisely that occupation. In other words, overcoming ecological disorder. And why is there ecological disorder? Well, that's because wretched I that I am, right? I wanna order creation my own way. And of course, when I order creation in my own way, Greek word for order, Greek word for order is cosmos. The opposite of cosmos in Greek, and for us in English as well, chaos. And so you see, again, the crazy thing, when I start ordering my own world, it's going to be orderly chaos. That's what it results in. Futility, destruction, death, chaos. And so here again, the sense, the ecological disorder comes about because of our way of wanting to order. And our way of wanting to order again, putting this cosmos in this way, goes back to Genesis 3. When that tricky little serpent says, well, you want to be like God, don't you? And they go, why, sure, you betcha. And there you go. Cosmos becomes chaos. And you see precisely Genesis 2 and 3 are of a piece. Genesis 2 is how God is putting the world together, the cosmos. And he starts putting it together by creating Adam, the human being, right? The Adam, the man from Adama, the dust. And so you've got dust and you've got God's breath of life, and they come together. And then once you get that, you got to have a place for the guy to live. So you have a little garden, and you have some plants and trees and flowers, but he's still a little lonely, so you get some animals in there, and you know, so Spot and Fluffy, and you know, they're all, but it's still not enough. And so finally, you get a partner, a help. And that's going along pretty well until they decide, we'd like to be God. And then it all starts to fall apart again. And we end up at the end of Genesis 3 with those words that we have on Ash Wednesday. Remember that you are dust, and to dust you will return, right? Dust, breath of life, now once again separate. Yes.
The implication here is that death is unnatural, that it was introduced in a sense by humans. What we tend to think of, if you're thinking of a Christian ecological theology, there is generally an understanding that an ecological order includes death. I mean, that is the way we perceive it. And if true freedom from bond, it is a freedom from bondage to decay, that suggests that it's a much more profound kind of freedom from bondage. And how are humans supposed to help nature get free from what we think of as the natural order? Does all that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Because here again, I think that the sense of death and the way that Paul has set it up again is that life and death are understood primarily in terms of that relationship with God and living in the presence of God. So again, back to what will separate us from the love of God? Separated from the love of God is death. And that even what happens here in creation, it's not that, again, as we ourselves would say in faith, Well, is physical death going to separate us from the love of God?
No way!
So is physical death, right? Are those folks cutting down that tree over there? Is cutting down that tree going to separate that creation from the love of God?
No way!
Right. And so our sense there of creation and helping to establish that order is again recognizing that relationship. We are all in the love of God. In other words, the whole sense of what creation is a participatory phenomenon. In other words, and again, it's a good thing we're meeting here, creation is koinonia. Right? We understand the Christian community as koinonia, the commonness, the communality, the community of faith. But Paul's understanding is saying, you know, the ecology of faith recognizes that all of creation is koinonia. And we are part of, or creation participates in, this koinonia. Right? And so therefore, again, our responsibility, what we are free for as Christians, is to work on restoring this koinonia of creation, the koinonia of which we all are a part. So it's, again, a communal sense. And I said that yesterday, again, for Paul, salvation is never merely individualistic and privatistic. It is personal because it is for me, but it is for you, for us, for all of creation. So that Paul always thinks communally, koinonially, about creation, about salvation, in terms of humans and in terms, here we see, of the whole creation. That's what's going on. Okay? All right, so what's the problem here with creation? Verses 22 and 23, I want to be a little quick about that. That is that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains. Okay, and again, that's an all right translation. There's two words here for groaning and labor. One word for groaning, systenazai, and one word for labor pains. And synhodonai. So it's systenazai, synhodonai, with an and in between. Now you can put those two together, groaning in labor pains, if, as all you grammarians know, it's hendiados, right? Two words to say one thing. I kind of want to keep them separate because the notion for groaning, that word there pertains particularly to mourning, the groaning at the time of death. Labor pains, of course, fits with birth. So in other words, I think the reason I want to keep them a little separate is that creation is groaning in terms of all the death that is going on. It's mourning, but it's also groaning, making noises because of the births that are going on. And again, onomatopoetically, in Greek, those are two different ways of groaning. When you're mourning, you go, oh, I. But when you're giving birth, right, you go, oh, no. Mothers here, if that was it. Or another way of putting it is to think, when you are mourning, you say, oh, God, differently than in giving birth.
Oh, God!
I know I'm going to get it. But the sense here is again, from birth to death or from death to birth, the whole gamut. Creation is groaning because of what we have done and what is going on there. And then in verse 33, now we're, or, excuse me, 23, we're going to switch to ourselves, right? Not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit. Now, in that little phrase, that we have the first fruits or the first installment of the Spirit, particularly for a Jewish Christian reader of this text or hearer of this text, that phrase, we have the first fruits of the Spirit, would strike them as odd. Because remember, from the Hebrew understanding, the Jewish practice, first fruits is an offering which we are to give to God. The first fruits offering is there in Deuteronomy, and if time would allow, we could look at it. But here, it's the reversal. The first fruits, the first installment, it's what God gives to us. God, if you will, sacrifices or offers for us. Taking us right back again to Christ's cross and resurrection. Right? God dwells, the Spirit dwells in us. Christ dwells in us. That's the first fruits. That's the installment that we have. Right? And because we have that, right, now, right, while we groan inwardly, there is also hope. Verse 24. For in hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what is seen? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Is that groan the same groan?
Which one? Verse 23?
Mm-hmm. Is it the same groan as the previous groan?
Yes. It is specifically there, it is the groaning that has to do with mourning.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So it Paul doesn't use both terms in verse, but he uses
right.
the more, right?
Right.
Ooh-ah. All right, I want to talk about hope. And Paul's notion of hope and what he means about hope was already articulated in chapter 4, verse 18. So if you would look at chapter 4, verse 18, please, and if someone would read that for us. It's again the great chapter that talks about Abraham and his faith. And anyone who finds that
against all hope, Abraham in hope believed, and so became the father of many nations, just as it had been said of him, so shall your offspring be. That's 18.
Great, that's all we need. There's that funny little phrase there, hope against hope. And for Paul, there are two ways of hoping. Really, there's only one way of hoping in terms of genuine hoping. That's it. But again, a lot of us will think about hope. Our usual way of thinking about hope is hope according to hope. Hope according to hope is in terms of what we can reasonably expect. I don't know if it's reasonable or not, but I hope I get through this section. that's what's going here for reasonable expectation. And that what is going there is that what we reasonably expect, our hope, to link it up to futility and all of that, is our telos, our end, our aim, our purpose. And what our hope leads to is, right, that we hope there is no impediment, no obstacle to the telos. I hope to take a hike up to Holden Lake. Now, actually, that's what I'm going to do. My hope really isn't there. What am I hoping there? I'm hoping it doesn't rain. I'm hoping it won't be too hot. I'm hoping I won't break my leg on the way out of this building.
Too many flies.
Right. I'm hoping there's not too many flaws. In other words, all of my hope according to hope is conditional. And what I'm doing is I'm hoping that the conditions will be right for me to accomplish my goal. I'm hoping there are no impediments and obstacles. And so, if there are no flies and it's not too hot and it doesn't rain, I know. And why do I have to hope this? Because, of course, I don't know it. I don't know right now if there's too many flies or if it's not going to rain or what, because I haven't looked at weather reports and all of that. But that's not really hope. That's just kind of conditions and stating what's going on. Hope against hope is that, again, of course, you are going to have your telos. Whether or not it is reasonable will be brought into question. The other conditions and everything, the hope against hope is, you know, let's say, the negatives. Let's use Abraham and Sarah. Hope according to hope would be if God would come to 22-year-old Sarah and 30-year-old Abraham and say, you'll have kids. And they go, well, you know, if we kind of put together, yeah, we'll have kids. But now God comes to 90-year-old Abraham and 82-year-old Sarah, who's been barren all her life, and says, you're going to be so fruitful that all the nations of the earth will be blessed for you. Whoa, Abraham and Sarah, hey, kind of, we know the negatives. Like, you know, God, you know, women 82 years old, we're not calling them fruitful, are we? I know the negatives, right? Or to be very crass, Abraham and Sarah don't have a hope in hell to have it. But hope against hope, they say, I don't know what that crazy God is all about, but if God says we're going to have children, we'll have children. I have no way of knowing how that's going to happen. Right? I mean, all the conditions that would seem to allow that, I know that wouldn't happen. So now, what is my hope based on? It's not based on my reasonable expectations or anything else. It is based on golden theme, promise. And for that, God reckoned it to Abraham as righteous. God was doing the calculation there. But yeah. When you calculate promise, Abraham, Sarah, you've got it. Hope against hope. And that's what Paul's talking about here too in terms of our creation. Hope against hope is to say we know all the negatives, right? And, you know, not to diss any of our other teachers on staff this week, but, you know, they're really downers. Chuck Lux, Israel-Palestine problem, you know, peace and war, violence. Jonathan Frerich.
Boom!
Anita, wherever you are, I love you, but what? Tar sands and no water and cloudy. These guys are depressing. I understand. You know, I'm not the best, but I know why you come here. At least you're not depressed. I'm not trying to depress. But all these guys are depressing.
They are.
Because they know all the negatives, and yet they are here as people of God. Somehow, hope against hope, they're saying there will be peace in Israel. We don't have to be on the road to nuclear destruction and threats and violence. We don't have to live in our worlds in such a way that, again, we destroy the creation and make it futile. There's hope. And why, despite what we know? Because God promised. And how do we know that promise? We know that promise because Christ has died and Christ is risen. And we know that promise because that promise is there in the creation story. And that's the last thing I'll have to say, or get to say. Again, for us as Christians, for Paul, when he wants to tell us the creation story, where does he go? Where does he go to tell the creation? What's the creation story for Christians?
The cross.
Resurrection.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? Let me...
First Peter.
Let me read for you one of our creation stories. I'll take this one from Luke 24, starting at chapter 1. But on the first day of the week, at early dawn, let the reader understand in the beginning. So we're starting out in the beginning. And again, where do we come? To a situation of chaos, destruction, and death, right? They came to the tomb without form and void. What? They found the stone rolled away. Already, some of the obstacles and impediments are gone. And while they were perplexed about this, suddenly, two men in dazzling clothes, so on and so forth. And you know the story, right? Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but has risen. Creatio ex nihilo, like creation out of nothing. Where there was nothing but death, destruction, decay, God made life. That's our creation story. Cross and resurrection is our creation story. And in case you didn't get it, Luke will try again in verse 13 and following about these two guys or people who are trotting down to Emmaus. And then they're joined by this stranger. And they start talking about him and all of these things. And then again in verse 21 they say, but we had hoped, there's our word again, hoped that he was the one to redeem Israel. But you see, those two disciples, their problem was they were still hoping according to hope. And when your Messiah gets crucified, my endgame goal and purpose is futile. But, well, it's not the right story, right? The stranger says, no. If you'd look at the scriptures, you would see that what's going on is always hope against hope. And God's promises are such that God will raise to life all. And again, how do they know that? When they hear the word, and then finally, as the stranger sits down, takes, blesses, breaks, and gives. Right? Our Eucharistic actions. But those verbs are verbs of creation. That's how God creates. God takes, blesses, breaks, distributes, and gives. And so that too is how we will participate in creation. Think about that in terms of the Easter Vigil. And if you have an Easter Vigil, of course, the story, the creation story, is the resurrection itself. But before then, we read 3, 5, 7, 12, and you should read all 12, quite frankly, of these other stories from the scriptures, and what? They're all stories of resurrection. You know, take the Exodus. Israel is dead in Egypt, captive and enslaved, and God creates a people and life. Resurrection. A resurrection that indeed the people who put this together said, well, you know, the reason we got that story and understand it the way we do is because of our creation story. God raised Jesus from the dead. And so for us, in terms of our understanding now in ecology of the cross, our understanding of how we are set free for creation is precisely going about it in this way. John says about Jesus, in him was life. And for us now, if Christ dwells in us, we can say, in us is life. And then because we are Christ, we can also be life-giving for all of creation. So that it need no longer groan, but indeed participate with us in that great community that celebrates the liberation, the salvation, the redemption of the whole of creation. Thank you. Thank you.